Nah, we just trying to win this dance
club.
You're staying alive on 101.9 with Marco on Astrotop.
We got the Refugees All Stars, Robert Devin in the club, Y Clef Jean.
Look at here, look at shorty got back. Should I ask her for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cats talking to her, buying her fake furs and taking her to the fever.
Welcome, you're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Thursday, it's 3 o'clock, and it's time for another 1/2 hour of astronomy talk with your host Marco on CITR's Astro Talk.
Ouija's, check the spelling, R-E-F-U-G-E. E, get the CD from Sam Goody. You ain't even close with the rhymes that you wrote. Don't be mad cause you broke. Let me clear my throat.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9 FM.
Me, I'm eating mangoes in Trinidad with attorneys. Yeah. My food slang flow worldwide like a current. Went to every spot where nobody got insurance. Rubber do the math, you ain't half niggas at it. My man's claim true, you forget about it. Ho-ho, just a new stance, like my influence. Well recognized, you a lie trying to do it. Got you, told your lady, oops, we nuts, baby. Smooth and charismatic, automatic, you gon' save me. God bless the dead as my son survive. We strive to teach you, baby, and stay alive.
Okay, welcome again. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So, where was I? Oh, yeah, I was talking about the length of the day. Yesterday was the shortest day of the year, and today our day will be 8 seconds longer. The day before that, the day was 1 second longer. Then it became, that was Tuesday. Then it became the shortest day of the year, so it was 1 second shorter. And today, our day is going to be 8 seconds longer. So the amount of heat we receive, the amount of sunlight, doesn't depend on if we're closest to the sun or not, because at this time of the year, we are about the closest that we're going to get to the sun. So that depends on the tilt of the axis and not on how close we are. So in the summer, I believe we are the farthest from the sun that we are during the year, in the midsummer. So some things to talk about. Anyway, welcome. I was mentioning last week, I keep trying to find the interview I did at the LIGO Observatory. Can't find it. So it was on my recorder and then it disappeared. So I'm going to just talk about another thing. There's something called Pandora Up Close. This is an article on NASA. It's from the Cassini spacecraft. It's a picture of the moon Pandora. And it's on www.nasa.gov, dated December 22nd. And it's the article is Pandora Up Close. Shows an irregular shaped moon. The moon, if it's irregular shaped, that means it does not have enough mass to form a perfect sphere or close to a perfect sphere. Doesn't have enough mass, doesn't have enough gravity. So this is an irregular shape. So the caption says, this image from NASA's Cassini spacecraft is one of the highest resolution views ever taken of Saturn's moon Pandora. Pandora, 52 miles across. So that's something like from here to Bellingham. Orbits Saturn just outside the narrow F ring. So that's very interesting. It's a cute little moon. It's got dimples. I guess it'd been pocked with some kind of meteorite. It's got little crater imprints on its surface all over the place. And it has quite a few big ones. So I guess it's been hit by something. Anyway, the spacecraft Cassini captured the image during its closest ever flyby of Pandora on December 18th, 2016, during the third of its grazing passes by the outer edges of Saturn's main rings. The image was taken in green light with a Cassini spacecraft narrow-angle camera at a distance of approximately 25,000 miles or 40,000 kilometers from Pandora. Image scale is 787 feet or 240 meters per pixel. I'm not sure what that means. Image scale is 787 feet per pixel. I don't know what that means. Let me think about that. The Cassini-Huygens mission is a cooperative project of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Italian Space Agency. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory runs the show. Okay, so now we're going to look at Pluto. This is called Pluto New Horizons, and the title of the article is Exploring Pluto and a Billion Miles Beyond. It's a blog, and writing today is Alan Stern of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He's the principal investigator for NASA's New Horizon mission. So remember last summer, the New Horizon mission flew by Pluto. It was quite an exciting mission because as we spoke, Pluto had not done one complete orbit around the Earth since its discovery. I believe it was discovered in 1930. So it think its orbit's about 250 or more years to orbit once. I think Neptune still hasn't gone around once since we've discovered it. So scientists were not didn't have exact figures on the orbit, and they had to look back years ago where astronomers took photos and they extrapolated it. But one of the dangers was there was no way to control the camera once it got there. They had to pre-program all the instructions to the spacecraft, to the cameras, and imagine what would happen if the spacecraft New Horizons flew by. Their calculations was wrong, their cameras were open, their sensors were open for the test, and they miscalculated and Pluto was not where they thought it would be. So this was a very stressful time, I guess, for the astronaut or for the astronomers, because they had put in all this work and they were hoping that their calculations from the partial data they got on the orbit of Pluto would have them, when they arrived at Pluto, Pluto would be right there in front of their cameras, and it was. So now it's a blog by Alan Stern, and I'm going to read his blog. As 2016 ends, I can't help but point out an interesting symmetry in where the mission has recently been and where we are going. Exactly 2 years ago, we had just taken New Horizons out of cruise hibernation to begin preparations for the Pluto flyby. So isn't that cool? It was in hibernation for quite a few years before it got to Pluto, I guess to save fuel. And exactly 2 years from now, we will be on our final approach to our next flyby, which will culminate with a very close approach to a small Kuiper Belt object, KBO, called 2014 MU69, a billion miles farther out than Pluto on January 1st, 2019. So that's just over 2 years from now. Just now is 2016's end. We are at the halfway point between these two milestones. So we're at the halfway point between Pluto, or the New Horizons spacecraft was taken out of hibernation. I'm not sure how long did it take, 10 years to fly there. We'll find out hopefully soon. But through a lot of its flight, it was in hibernation, obviously to conserve fuel or to conserve batteries, things like that. Now I'm getting back to the article. During this phase between flyby operations, all of the systems and scientific instruments aboard New Horizons are healthy. In October, we completed the 16-month-long transmission of all Pluto flyby data to Earth. So it took 16 months to transmit all the data back. Our science team is now steadily analyzing those data, making new discoveries and writing reports to research journals like Science, Nature, Icarus, the Journal of Geophysical Research, and the Astronomical Journal. Almost 50 scientific papers reporting new results about Pluto and its systems of moon were submitted this year. Talking about data, I was watching Star Trek, what's it called? Star Trek, not Voyager, that's where 7 of 9 is. I forget what the name of it. Captain Jean-Luc Picard. Data was taking over the ship. Data had a malfunction. The Automon data. Okay, getting back to the article. Additionally, our science and science operation teams have made two major Pluto submissions to NASA's archive of all planetary mission data, the Planetary Data System, PDS. Two final submissions to the PDS will be made in 2017, wrapping up the archiving of Pluto data for others in the scientific community to use. Those upcoming submissions will include better calibrated databases resulting from the intensive post-Pluto flyby calibration campaign we conducted this summer using all 7 payload instruments aboard New Horizons and a series of meta products like maps and atmospheric profiles created from New Horizons data. I wonder if they let citizen scientists get in on this data, because there are some things where NASA lets citizen scientists review its data because it has so much data, not enough workers. And a lot of these citizen scientists make amazing discoveries. So I guess I should be doing something like that. Okay, anyway, getting back to the article. This year ahead, we'll begin with observation of a half dozen Kuiper Belt objects by our LORI telescope imager in January. So that'll be exciting. I hope to see that. These observations, like the ones we made in 2016, of another half dozen Kuiper Belt objects, are designed to better understand the orbits, surface properties, shapes, satellite systems, and frequency of rings around these objects. These observations can't be done from any ground-based telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope, or any other spacecraft, because all of those resources are either too far away or viewing from the wrong angles to accomplish this science. So this work is something that only New Horizons can accomplish. Now, there is, finish that. There's a bunch of little answers to the blogs. Okay, so isn't that exciting? We have all these Kuiper Belt objects, and I guess some of them will be dwarf planets, as our former planet Pluto now is a dwarf planet. So maybe they will discover some very interesting things. Okay, so let's see. I'm trying to queue up some things, and I'm going to come back after a commercial break. So this is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow across it, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Let's do some quick yes or no questions. Are the following things technically possible? Life on other planets, is that theoretically possible?
Yes.
Okay. What about a Schwarzschild wormhole?
Yes.
Okay, what about this? Me going on a date with Charlize Theron?
No.
What, not at all? In no universe?
No.
In none of the infinite universes does that happen?
No.
It's completely beyond the bounds of scientific possibility is what you're saying?
Yes.
Quick follow-up question. In any of those potential universes, am I the one rejecting her, and that's why it doesn't work out?
No. You do realize that typing your response is difficult for me, correct?
Okay, sure, yeah. It's just I'm trying to play this out because I'm just trying to see if there was any hypothetical hope.
No.
It doesn't matter. But never say never. Okay, if time travel were possible, would you want to go back in time and refuse to do this interview?
Yes.
You truly are an incredibly smart man. Stephen Hawking, thank you so much for your time. You've stated that you believe there could be an infinite number of parallel universes. Does that mean that there is a universe out there where I am smarter than you?
Yes, and also a universe where you're funny.
Okay, all right. Look, if you're so smart, what number am I thinking
13.
Of? It was 13. I was thinking of 13. Okay, that was a lucky guess. What am I thinking right now?
That you've been a huge disappointment for your family.
I wasn't thinking that.
This is going out to the whole wide west side. Know what I'm saying? Yeah. Break it down for me. Steady mobbing, rock, rock on. I was just a young boy living in the hub city. Eastside Compton. Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had every talking about, boy, you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super spoke and told us all how to ride for the west coast. Put my music in me where you at, throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the Bay, what you say? All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around, we got the whole world locked down. No, don't stop, we won't stop. That's why I put it down for the west side.
Didn't seem that long ago.
Oh no.
We were still in 40s out the liquor store.
Oh no.
Mama started tripping, so it's time to go.
Out to the park with the locusts.
Everybody broke smoking roaches.
DJ Quick was the had every claiming he was from the CPT.
Y'all remember?
One time tried to clown. We had to burn this bitch on down.
One time for my was in incarceration.
Place a dime with you, but having lots of patience.
Times for my sisters at the county bill.
I got some Westside love for all you ghetto children.
Three times for my that been passed away.
I took some cure for you and pray for better days.
One day everything's gonna be fine.
But until that day, my only reply is Westside till I
my
die.
Welcome back. That was TQ on the West Side. So we're getting back to our show. And it's the new year, so I have to start thinking about getting some new stuff. New music, new commercials, new breaks, new everything. Been working hard on other things, so I'm going to start a website. Like I've said that before, I started it, but it was attacked, it's ruined, so I'm getting a professional to do it. I'm going to put a lot of web shows on it, a lot of podcasts of different topics. I'm going to do one of women in science, triumph, astronomy, material science, and other things, so stay tuned for that soon. So now I'm getting back to the show. We're going to meet a spacecraft dressmaker. What's a spacecraft dressmaker? This is on www.nasa.gov, and it's the dated December 20, 2016. So we don't think about this, do we? Astronauts have to have blankets to sleep in, clothes to wear on the spacecraft. And when they go on spacewalks, they have to wear funky spacesuits. On launch, they have to do that too. So we're going to talk about that. What do they wear and who designs it? Well, the title of the article is Meet a Spacecraft Dressmaker. The lady's name is Lien Pham, and it shows her pulling material for a thermal blanket in NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory shield shop. Okay, I'm going to read the article now. Lien Pham sometimes thinks of herself as a spacecraft dressmaker. She's been making thermal blankets at JPL for 16 years. Just as clothing can be sewn too tight or too loose, thermal blankets, the glinting material each spacecraft is wrapped in to regulate its temperature, have to be cut to form. A thermal blanket has to provide just the right amount of heat, not too much and not too little, for the spacecraft to operate correctly. Well, I didn't know spacecraft had thermal blankets, so I'm learning something today. Pham is a member of Flight Technician Services, a group at JPL that contributes to all stages of spacecraft assembly. Her particular team, which designs and fabricates the protective thermal blankets, is called the Shield Shop. Now, this is interesting. I didn't know they had to. And it also shows here a guide to different materials used in thermal blankets. And there's not just thermal blankets. There's socks. And here's a Christmas stocking made out of a thermal blanket hanging in the JPL shop. At JPL, a place known for complex engineering, Pham has a different background. She began her career as a seamstress after her family immigrated to the U.S. from Vietnam. Her experience behind a sewing machine has informed how she makes thermal blankets. We sat down to talk to Pham and her life at JPL. How did you start your career? That's the first question. My family left Vietnam in 1978. At that time, we were persecuted as Roman Catholics in a communist country. My family also had ties to the deposed South Vietnamese government and were targeted for political persecution. When I first came to the U.S., I settled in L.A. I could only get a job sewing, and I made $2.10 an hour. To find a better job, I attended a trade school in the San Fernando Valley. At night, they had basic courses in electronic assembly, which trained her in soldering and cabling. In the 1980s, the aerospacecraft industry in Southern California was booming. She found jobs at two companies, Datametrics and Litton Inc., doing cabling for terrestrial vehicle and space satellites. Now, that's interesting. So remember, when I used to go to L.A. in the mid-1980s, I actually went to the space firms to apply for jobs. And at that time, the Los Angeles area had the largest or the biggest or the densest concentration of scientists in the world. And I still think it's right up there. Spacecraft electronics are unique. They're not like what you find in electronic shops at a mall. It takes a lot of skill to connect all the cables. Now the second question to Pham is, how did you find your way to JPL? In 1994, I got hired onto the Cassini mission as a cabler for 3 years. So that must be interesting, doing cabling on spacecraft, putting cables in. Now there's a picture of her, Pham. She's in a white suit with a white mask, white gloves, and Richard Frisbee, after adding thermal blanketing to a pressurized tank for the Mars Science Laboratory descent stage. So, it's strange, but I just found out everything has to have a thermal blanket. I didn't know that. So in 1994, she got hired onto the Cassini mission as a cabler for 3 years. In 2000, her friend Mary Reeve, a cable engineer she worked with, told her they were hired in the shield shop. Although Pham loved sewing, it had made some kind of kids' clothes. She had never worked with thermal blankets. She said to the person that was hiring, if you're willing to train me, I'm willing to try. I didn't know it would be something I'd enjoy and work at for 16 years. So she's been working at this for 16 years. So now the question to her is, what kind of materials go into a thermal blanket? Pham answers, we use multiple layers of mylar films with Dacron netting. I'm not sure what Dacron netting is. To separate them, for the outermer surface, we use Kapton film or beta cloth, which resists temperature change. We also use gold Kapton, which is good for conducting electricity. There's a black material called carbon field Kapton. That's for a charged environment with a lot of electricity. It dissipates the charge. So that's interesting. All these materials have a lot of uses or functions. So there's a carbon material called Kapton, which dissipates electrical charge. I never realized that electrical charge could build up, but I guess it can. So the next question to Pham is, what's the toughest material to work with? She says Teflon. Some spacecraft require it, but tape doesn't stick to its surface. Tape is a part of the blanket making process. At one point, we asked, how are we going to build the material if the tape's not sticking? We came up with a fabrication method that creates a hem like you would see in clothing where the material is folded and then sewn. Then the next question to Pham is, what kind of tools do you use? We use commercial sewing machines designed for thick materials such as denim. It has a walking feed that pulls in the material and cuts our sewing thread automatically. We also use a variety of hand tools like a measuring scale, scissors, surgical scalpels, hole punches, a heat gun, leather punch, and weight scale. I guess having people around like that, I think she worked for a few years on cabling, and then now she's been doing these blanketing for 16 years. Having a person with that kind of skill is very valuable for NASA. I guess we never think about that. We never think that things need blankets or... And this got me thinking. I thought originally from the title of the article, we were talking about she makes materials for the astronaut to wear, but she doesn't. So that's another thing. Who makes the materials for the astronauts to wear? Who makes their clothes? Who makes their spacesuits? It's a real complicated process. There's so many things that have to be considered. And I myself would have never thought about this one. But anyway, let's go on. Another question to Pham is, what do you enjoy about this work? She says most people don't see the end of a project. They just do their part and it moves on. I like blanketing because I'm able to contribute to a project from beginning to end. On the Mars Science Laboratory, I was one of the last people to touch the spacecraft before launch. That's interesting. I was one of the last to touch the Curiosity rover that it carried to Mars. We had to install the last thermal blanket called the Windbreaker before sending the mission off to Mars. So I never realized that. Everything has to have a thermal blanket. Is that, I'm wondering, is that before launch, during launch, or after launch? I'm not sure, but it's interesting. Next question is, do you still sew clothing for yourself? I still sew for my kids as a hobby. For example, my eldest daughter is getting married next year and is spending a lot of time on bridal dresses for her and her bridesmaids. The last question is, any advice for someone who is interested in space and JPL, that's a Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but doesn't necessarily have a science or an engineering background? FAM answers, work hard and keep an open mind. It's never too late to learn and take classes. There are a lot of people at JPL who didn't start in science or engineering, but almost all of them have the drive to learn new skills or search for training. So that's an interesting thing. Like last week, I talked about the food. When and if, I guess it'll be an if one day, maybe in 2030, when the, it'll be a when in 2030, when humans go to Mars. The first mission might be they fly to Mars, just like they did to the moon, but they don't land on moon, just like on Mars, so just like they did with the moon. So I believe on the first manned or human project to the moon, the astronauts circled the moon, but they didn't land. The next few missions did. So that's what they might do in Mars. They might send human beings up there and not land. So landing and getting out and staying there is a whole new challenge. So I guess it's a big enough challenge just to get there. So who's going to be the first human beings to get to Mars, see it up close? That should be cool. I'll volunteer. Okay, so now it's another article that say December date. Sorry, my tongue is getting twisted. Dated December 21st, 2016. And it's from NASA.gov, and the article is called Interstellar, Crossing the Cosmic Void. Humanity's great leap into space between the stars has, in a sense, already begun. NASA's Voyager 1, which I talk about a lot, or often enough, but NASA's Voyager 1 probe broke through the sun's magnetic bubble to touch the interstellar wind. Voyager 2 isn't far behind. New Horizons shot past Pluto on its ways to encounter on its way to encounters with more distant dwarf worlds, the rubble at the solar system's edge. Closer to home, we're working on techniques to help us cross greater distances. Astronauts feast on romaine lettuce grown aboard the International Space Station, perhaps a preview of future banquets en route to Mars or to deep space. For the moment, sending humans to other stars remain firmly in the realm of science fiction, as in the new film Passengers, when hibernating travelers awaken in mid-flight. That's an interesting thing to consider. The first thing that we were talking about today was the New Horizons mission to the dwarf planet Pluto. For a lot, 6 to 8 years, the spacecraft was in hibernation. Then 2 years before its anticipated rendezvous with the dwarf planet Pluto, yes, the dwarf planet Pluto, it came out of hibernation and started warming up and started getting prepared for its mission. So will people do the same? Will they hibernate and awaken in mid-flight? That's an interesting thing. I don't know if that can be done. Maybe we have to send bears up there to do that. That's a good idea. We'll send a bear who's just about to hibernate, and when it wakes up, it'll be on its way. Okay, back to the article. By what NASA so far has proposed, no new missions beyond our solar system. Scientists and engineers are sketching out possible technologies that might one day help them to get us there. NASA's Journey to Mars, a plan aimed at building on robotic missions to send humans to the red planet, could be helping lay the groundwork. And so says Jeffrey Sheehy, a NASA Space Technology Missions Directorate, Chief Engineer in Washington, D.C., and quote, propulsion, power, life support, manufacturing, communication, navigation, robotics, the journey to Mars is going to force us to make advances in every one of these areas. Those systems are not just going to be advanced enough to do an interstellar mission, but Mars is stepping us in that much further in space. It's a step along the way to the stars. Now, won't that be interesting if you're alive 50 to 100 years from now? What kind of technology will be available? Okay, charting the unknown, the next part of the article. Hurling ourselves, passenger style, to the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, would require crossing almost inconceivably vast distances. We would truly need exotic technology, such as suspended animation or multi-generational life support. That places in person's visit well out of reach, at least for the near term. But the possibility of robotic interstellar probes is coming into much sharper focus. Space probes pioneer, say, the radiation, energy, and particle-based space between the stars. The so-called interstellar medium is itself a worthy science destination. So says Leon Alkali, an engineering fellow at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And quote, we need more explorers, more of the local probes into this region so we can understand better these interface conditions between our sun and interstellar medium. Like the ancient mariners, we want to start creating a map. Alkali's report, he wrote a report in 2015 on exploring interstellar space, and it was called Science and Enabling Technologies for the Exploration of the Interstellar Medium. This report maps out the knowns and unknowns of largely uncharted regions, from the dark, distant dwarf worlds of the Kuiper Belt to the Boshok, the turbulent transition thought to separate the sun's bubble of plasma from the interstellar wind. Drawing on the work of more than 30 specialists during two workshops at the Keck Institute for Space Studies, the report poses pressing questions about the structure, composition, and energy flow in this cosmic vastness, and it paints one of the most detailed pictures yet of a possible interstellar probe using present-day technology. Part of the report focuses on a design reference mission, a conceptual starting point that allowed workshop scientists to begin teasing out some of the technical requirements of an interstellar probe. The resulting probe concept was meant to be daring, challenging, inspirational, and catch the mind of the public, and a rational first step towards attempting to reach another star. It's the latest in a long line of interstellar probe concepts by NASA scientists stretching back to the 1970s. So I'm just going to add a few comments here. We haven't gone to Mars. When I was younger, I thought the target date was set about 2015, but that date has been pushed back to 2030. Who knows if 2030 will be the time. But just going to Mars, the first stage would be sending people to Mars, would be to have them go to Mars, orbit Mars, do a bunch of tests, and come back, but not land. Imagine landing and then taking off again would require a whole new set of challenges to overcome. So we're 15, 20 years away from going to Mars. Imagine going to interstellar space. Now the sun's magnetic field protects us from the interstellar medium. So the interstellar medium, even though it is not very dense, there's radiation. There's a bunch of harmful things out there that could kill us. So imagine traveling between stars. Now that would require a whole new advance in technology, something that is the lucky people, if the Earth is still around then, 100 years from now, maybe they'll be doing it. So part of the report focuses on a design reference mission, a conceptual starting point that allowed scientists to begin teasing out some of the technical requirements of an interstellar probe. In this conceptual scenario, the disc-shaped probe is in a bullet-shaped housing, is launched as payload on the Space Launch System, NASA's next big rocket in the late 2020s, with gravitational boosts from Earth, Jupiter, and the Sun itself, it could reach interstellar space in just 10 years. By comparison, it took Voyager 36 years to reach the heliopause, or the boundary of interstellar space. I think within 5 years they're going to turn the Voyagers off. I think they have been in stages turning off certain functions of Voyager to conserve the power as long as they can. But I believe within 5 to 10 years all the power will be turned off, and wouldn't that be cool if we could overtake it or find Voyager where it is? So remember, right now, if you open your refrigerator, there's a little tiny light bulb in there that gives out light. That's how much wattage the signal is that is coming from Voyager. So Voyager has been traveling for 36 years. So imagine how far it is away. And it's just sending a little signal that is so weak, a little light bulb. So that's hard to imagine. Could we see, let's say I live, or let's say if I look a block away or a mile away, could I see a little light bulb? Probably not in the daytime. In nighttime, maybe. But imagine something that's billions and billions and billions of miles away. So that's the energy of the light bulb that is being sent by Voyager. Okay, so I'm going to take another break as soon as I can get my cursor to work. When I return, I'm going to keep talking about astronomy and space stuff. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on 101.9.
A lot of hardcore stuff is just is fast, very aggressive and loud, you know, music, angry music.
I am your host, Mr. Steeston Mike. Welcome to the Flex Your Head Show on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm here every Tuesday,
6 to 8 p.m.
Playing some punk and hardcore for you. If you want to hear something, feel free to give me a call at 604-822-2487 or swing by flexyourhead.net and send us an email with a request.
Welcome back. This is Marco on CITR 101.9. You're listening to AstroTalk. It's hard to cross my legs. I was walking on the street the other day and I slipped on some ice, scratched my legs up. So hard to cross my legs, which I'm trying to do now. Okay, so now we're back to our thing about interstellar space. Now we're talking about a probe that could be sent to interstellar space. The probe would rely on both rockets and electrical power from next-generation radioisotope thermoelectric generators, enhanced versions of the kind now on board the Mars Curiosity rover. Such a probe would carry a variety of sensors and a communications antenna. It could investigate the interstellar meteor and its boundary, not the interstellar meteor, it could investigate the interstellar medium and its boundaries with the solar system, and perhaps even conduct a flyby of a Kuiper Belt object, one of the many unknown space bodies that orbit the Sun far beyond Pluto. Future studies could examine the possibility of electronic propulsion for the probe, or solar or electric sail. Now that would be cool. Now there is a picture here. It's from Apollo 8, the first manned mission to the Moon, entered lunar orbit on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1968. That evening, the astronauts held a live broadcast from lunar orbit, in which they showed pictures of the Earth and Moon as seen from their spacecraft. So here is like a nice picture of the Earth, and it has just like the Moon has its phases. It showed half of it Earth and half of it dark. Possible future technology like a solar gravitational lensing may give us pictures of other works detailed enough to reveal continents and ocean like this photo of Earth. So it's a beautiful photo of Earth, white and blue. So now talk about another technology called solar gravity, a window on another world. One of the most extraordinary conceptual spacecrafts detailed in the report also would exit the solar system, but only just, and its focus literally would be on alien worlds. This conceptual spacecraft would be parked in near interstellar space to use our sun as a gigantic lens, allowing zoomed-in close-ups of planets orbiting other stars. Now, isn't that cool? A space telescope would be lofted in position far beyond Pluto, some 550 times the distance from Earth to the Sun, or farther. It would take an advantage of an effect described by Einstein, the power of gravity to bend light rays. So, this is... Hang on, sorry about this. The stream of light from a distant star and its planet would be bent around the edges of the Sun, like water flowing around a rock, meeting on the other side at a focal point, where it would be greatly magnified. The telescope would be placed in just the right position to capture these images. The images would be smeared in a ring around the Sun, called an Einstein ring, and the technical challenges would be immense. The distortions would have to be corrected, and the fragmentary images reassembled. But if successful, the lens could be powerful enough to reveal surface features of an exoplanet, a planet around another star. Now that's cool. So says Alkali, the person from the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and quote, it would be almost like the Earthrise picture from the moon, recalling the iconic image sent back by the Apollo 8 astronauts in 1968. You would see clouds and continents and oceans, that kind of scale of images. From Earth, every image of an exoplanet is a single pixel. So you're looking with a straw at the exoplanet. If you want to image its continents on an exoplanet, you need something like the solar gravitational lens. Once we are ready to take the giant stride to another star, the problem of propulsion takes center stage. Carrying bulky fuel tanks could increase the mass of an interstellar probe beyond the realm of feasibility. So a lot of the things that we think that we use today, that we solid rocket boosters, things like that, we couldn't use them on such a long mission. Once we're ready to take the giant stride to another star, the problem of propulsion takes center stage. Carrying bulky fuel tanks could increase the mass of an interstellar probe beyond the realm of feasibility. I just said that. No, I said it again. But even reaching 1/10 the speed of light would allow a space probe to arrive at the nearest star in a 50-year time frame. We would never be able to accelerate to that kind of velocity using a chemical reaction, such as those in present-day rockets. One answer that might just possibly be within reach involves beamed energy. A powerful laser array, either on Earth's surface or in orbit, could be used to accelerate space probes equipped with sails to some fraction of the speed of light. NASA's Innovative Advanced Concept Program, NIAC, recently chose one such project, led by Philip Lubin at the University of California, Santa Barbara, to receive a second grant for further development. NIAC, which is the NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts Program, also recently provided funding for a conceptual project that might warm the hearts of Passengers fans, called Advanced Topor Induced Transfer Habitats for Human Status to Mars. This research effort by John Bradford of SpaceWorks, Inc. in Atlanta investigates how to place astronauts in a deep sleep state with reduced metabolic rates for trips between Earth and Mars. While it isn't true suspended animation or intended for interstellar travel, such a project highlights the extreme technical difficulties involved in sending fragile human bodies across the reaches of interstellar space. So, a lot of mind-bending stuff today, a lot of things that we aren't aware of, that a lot of little details that would be have to be addressed for space travel. Now here's one, printing a pizza. If our species ever attempts such trips, they could take many decades or even centuries, perhaps requiring some of suspension and revival of vessels that can sustain human life for several generations. So says astronaut Sheehy, and quote, maybe the people we launch won't be the people who actually reach Alpha Centauri. It will be their kids, but you've got to eat for those 80 years. Learning to grow food in space could help through growing plants from seeds, but growing plants in seeds requires real estate in space. A tomato plant is so big, a head of lettuce is a certain size. Another possibility is using 3D printers that can build 3D objects up layer by layer. Why couldn't we build a cell that way? Why couldn't we build food that way? Could you print a pizza? Interesting thoughts. Alkali also considers humor interstellar space an extremely distant project. The notion of sending humans to interstellar space is so far out in the sense that people need to have resources on the scale of a planet. The only sci-fi story like that I like that might have some scientific basis is not to build a Star Trek Enterprise, but to really hijack an asteroid. Imagine a population that would be able to travel on a binary asteroid. Then they could use one of them to swing the other one into interstellar space. Then you have resources on the asteroid, a source of iron, carbon, and other materials. They could mine that as a source of resources for living and for energy. You would have to imagine something like this designed for many, many generations. A lot of interesting thoughts today. But the daunting challenges, even to sending robotic probes to the stars, should be motivating, not discouraging, Sheehy said. And so says Sheehy, anywhere we've ever gone as humans, we always learn something, even if it's just over the next mountain range. A lot of times you discover something about yourself in a journey like that. We always find something that surprises us. Well, thank you for listening today. There was some really interesting stuff. There was that thing about going to Mars, going to interstellar space, a lot of new concepts, a lot of technologies, a whole new way of thinking. We have to jump an asteroid, travel on the asteroid. We have to be in suspended animation. A lot of interesting things to consider. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You've been listening to Astro Talk on 101.9. Next week, we'll see what I'm going to talk about. Bye for now.